Good morning, everyone. What a privilege to be with you all this morning, to worship with you and to be with you in God's presence, although we are at a larger distance from one another. I hope and pray that all of you are doing well in the midst of this unusual season of COVID-19 and long-winded election season. I also pray that all of you are finding ways to find hope and also courage to serve one another, to be there for one another. And thanks to everyone who is involved in making a Zoom worship work. This is a lot of work for the church, and I am grateful for churches that just keep doing it and finding ways to make it powerful and that would have impact on people's lives as they try to juggle all of these unusual things in their lives during this season. To be honest, after the creative sharing and the offering and the reflections on the text, I feel like, you know, we could just read those again and finish the service. Those were beautiful, well-crafted, and they capture the meaning of this text for us this morning. I title my sermon this morning, Liberating the Liberating God. In the sense that it's not that we are the ones liberating God, but I'm hoping that God and who God is for us as a liberating God would be liberated in our minds and our spirits as we continue to encounter God in the scriptures. The golden calf story is a direct criticism of the state-sponsored religion. I say state-sponsored religion because the story of the golden calf, as we read it in Exodus 32, seems to be a parody of, or a direct criticism of the story of King Jeroboam in 1 Kings 12, who fashioned two golden calves and put one in Bethel and one in Dan. The connection between 1 Kings 12 and Exodus 32 is evident in that both Jeroboam and Aaron describe the golden calf, saying, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." The plural, "your gods," work well with Jeroboam, who made two golden calves. But it clearly doesn't work well with Aaron, who fashioned only one golden calf. And that has been one of the reasons why scholars actually think that the story that in front of us in Exodus 32 is a criticism of Jeroboam. Read together, these two episodes, the one from 1 Kings 12 and Exodus 32, read together, these two episodes show that either the king or the priest have the ability to create a distorted image of God in order to respond to the people's fear in a time of leadership vacuum. In a leadership vacuum and out of fear of the future, an image of God was created by the king and the priest to please the masses. While the people are afraid of the future, their leaders fill in the gap for them by manufacturing a reductionist and a distorted view of God and of the past. The end result is a rebellion against God's commandment, God's vision for God's people as a liberating God. Idolatry, whether God is replaced by other deities or God is reduced to one single image or attribute or character, reflects a human desire to control what they do not see, including God. The people saw that Moses was absent. And instead of wondering what might have happened to Moses, and instead of discerning how long to wait for Moses, they immediately decided to take the matter into their own hands. The people gathered around Aaron and said to him, "Come, make gods for us, who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what has become of him." Their words reveal many aspects about how they view themselves, their God and their journey in the wilderness. First, they think they can make God. They think that God can be made, make God for us. Not only does this fly in the face of the first commandments in the 10 words, you shall have no other gods before me, you shall not make for yourself an idol. They also show that humans sometimes have the audacity to make God in their own image. The people are quite confused about who the originator of the Exodus plan. They kept on asserting the man Moses who led us out of Egypt. It is true that Moses had a role in leading the people out of Egypt. Even God told Moses, go confront Pharaoh and lead the people out of Egypt. But essentially, this act of liberation and justice was God's mission. The people wanted gods who would lead them into the future. Gods who would go before us, they say. So they want gods who would take them into the promised land. And Aaron responds to that need by fashioning a golden calf, which some scholars think that the golden calf here represents the god El, who was worshipped in the land of Canaan. Thus, the calf is possibly an attempt to control the future, to control the deity that controls the land of Canaan. But as they think about the future and as they are occupied by the fear of the future and the vacuum of leadership, Aaron rewrites the past by saying, "These are your gods, O Israel, that led you out of Egypt." So both the people who are afraid about the future and Aaron's failed leadership, they are trying to deal with the fears of the future by creating an idol that represents the past, that reduces the past, that maybe rewrites the past. If we were to put it in a slogan that would fit what we've been hearing for the past 4 years, make the future secure again, which might have meant rewriting the past, offering a distorted image of who God is and what the past was. In these muddy waters of idolatry, spaces in which people mix up God's self-revelation with their own image in a way that minimizes or distorts who God is, in this kind of context of idolatry, worship turns into a practice that is directed towards pleasing the self, satisfying the soul of those who are offering this worship. Instead of living out the vision and mission of liberation and justice by the ones who are being worshipped, worship becomes a consumer space in which humans create God in their own image, in order to please and meet their own needs. The people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to revel. Meanwhile, on the mountain, Moses does not know what's happening, but Yahweh knows and sees how the people are deviating so quickly from the path Yahweh has revealed to them. Interestingly, in response to the people's quick apostasy, Yahweh tells Moses, "Your people, whom you brought out of the hand of Egypt, have acted perversely." It sounds like God is now buying into what the people have said. "You, Moses, led them out of Egypt, and they are your people." Now, the Israelites are the people of Moses. Now, Moses is the one who brought them out of Egypt, even said by God, God's self. So this shows that idolatry is deeper than just distorting God's image in the hearts and the minds of those who worship God. Idolatry threatens the deep covenantal connection between God and the people. Even God, God's self, is willing to just tell Moses, "Your people, whom you led out of Egypt." God then asks Moses to leave God alone, to burn in anger so that God would destroy the people of Israel and start a whole nation from Moses. Unlike the reckless leadership of Aaron, Moses refuses to make this about himself. He implores, and more literally, before the face of the Lord, his God. It is this kind of relationship that allows Moses to be bold with his God. Indeed, God gives Moses this space by saying, "Leave me alone, Moses." Moses, through his prayers, does not leave God alone. Moses does not leave God alone, resting alone in God's anger. Even God needed Moses. Moses' prayer before the Lord was able to put a stop to Yahweh's plan to destroy the people. Because Moses was able to remind God that this people, sinful or not, are after all God's people. Moses was able to remind God that this Exodus plan was God's project. After all, God is the one who led the people out of Egypt with a mighty hand. Moses refused to make this about himself. He did that by having God worry about God's reputation among the nations, especially in the eyes of the Egyptians. It is not just about God's honor, though, in the eyes of the nations that Moses is appealing to. If we read closely Moses' words, Moses is confronting God with God's own character. Did you, God, take them out of Egypt for bad intention? Are you, after all, a bad God who would, with mighty hand, take the people out of slavery so that you would kill them in the wilderness? Did God take the people out of Egypt with bad intentions, or did God take them out of Egypt for the sake of liberation? Moses confronts God with who God is. Finally, Moses reminds God of who God is by making God think about what it means to be faithful. So Moses, also like Aaron, goes to the past deeds of Yahweh. Moses reminds Yahweh of the promises to the ancestors. But Moses does not do this in order to draw Yahweh and the people away from each other. Moses does it in order to draw Yahweh and the people closer to each other. Moses insists that God's faithfulness would be manifest for the whole people, even when they are sinful, especially when they are sinful. Moses refuses to make this about him. He wants God to be faithful to the promises of the ancestors. And because God is a relational God, because God is a faithful God to the covenant, God relented. God listened to Moses. God decided not to destroy the people. No wonder that the redactors of the book of Exodus interrupted the instructions of the tabernacle and the actual building of the tabernacle with this story of human rebellion, in order to assert that the ultimate voice in the book is that God desires to dwell in the midst of God's people, even when they are sinful. This divine mercy and divine compassion towards God's people is well captured in a midrash from the 9th century CE from a collection of midrashim called Biskita Rabita, or Great Sections. And I want to share with you this beautiful quotation. The midrash goes like this. God said, "When I conquer, I lose. When I am conquered, I gain. I conquer the generation of the flood, but did I not lose, for I destroyed my world? So too with the generation of the Tower of Babel, so too with the men of Sodom. But at the sin of the golden calf, I was conquered." This is a reference to Moses imploring before the Lord, God listening to the human partner. "But at the sin of the golden calf, I was conquered. Moses prevailed over me to forgive their sin, and I gained. I gained in that I did not destroy." So what are the idols that we have made in order to find security for the future? In what ways do we distort the past to find hope for a scary, unknown future? In what ways have we reduced God to an image in order to control God? How are we supposed to pray, intercede for Christians who have been co-opted by the idols of white supremacy and American nationalism? How are we supposed to pray, reminding God of God's old promises to liberate the oppressed and bring God's kingdom in its fullness so that God's creation, human or non-human, be healed? Amen.